on is, and focus a lot on, is talking about, like you said, kinematics and internal dynamics of Milky Way dwarf satellites. And particularly, the motivating question we're going to kind of hit at is, you know, are these things, is there evidence that these things are sitting in dark matter halos? What's the mass of these dark matter halos? You know, when we compare these to simulations of Theodolitea and sort of other models which predict cutoff scales in the small scale power spectrum, are these consistent? Okay. The question is, can we use these observations to sort of tell us something about the physical nature of dark matter? You know, you can ask, like, warm versus cold. Is this telling something about dark matter? What are we telling us something about sort of astrophysics, how they form, formation times? So let me just say, some of the newer results I'm going to present today just have been done primarily with a set of collaborators here and several other people. So let me just kind of jump into what my overview is. So as I said, the first thing I'm going to try to do is establish what the dark matter mass scale and mass function is of these new and old dwarf satellites. So we've actually taken to calling the older ones that were discovered pre-Sloan classical dwarf satellites. I don't know if that's going to stick or not, but so we're going to sort of independently, just sort of for historical reasons, separate these two out and look at the mass distributions of these guys independently. And we're going to have an eye, like I said, towards understanding what the nature of dark matter is in these systems. So there's going to be a second block of my talk, which is a topic we've been kind of thinking about a lot recently, which is sort of the three-dimensional spatial motions of stars in these galaxies. So we can consider sort of internal proper motions of stars, say, in these dwarf satellites, or at least the most luminous ones, as I'll show. And that can sort of shed light on this core versus cusp issue, which seems to continually plague CDM. And also, there's some work we've been recently looking at as far as understanding systematic motions, proper motions of the satellites themselves. Okay, and it's sort of orbital distributions of these guys. And if we learn something more about these proper motions, can we say, you know, compare to orbital dynamics and CDM simulations to understand if these two distributions are consistent with each other? So these are kind of the two blocks that I'll be focusing on. And let me just go ahead and kind of jump right into it here as far as the first one. So here's a kind of a cartoon as far as what our motivations are. So really, I guess one of the more fundamental questions you can ask in all of astronomy is, what is the minimum mass dark matter halo that exists in the universe? What is the minimum mass galaxy that exists? So Beth was kind of showing the definition of what a galaxy is sort of going under a redefinition these days because we're discovering these systems and we don't really know, you know, are they globular clusters, are they galaxies, are they star clusters, you know, what the heck are they? So here's actually an older version of the figure that Beth showed, and there's actually a couple more of these new satellites that need to be thrown on here. So these darker red ones here are the classical dwarf satellites, and you can see these are distributed in a semi-random way around the Milky Way. The brighter red ones are the newer ones. Once again, there's a couple more that needs to go on here. But basically, the question is, we want to ask is, you know, how do we map this on the theory? Okay, how do we map this on the theories of dark matter? So if you just look at a very, very, very crude cartoon of what the mass function of dark matter halos looks like, and this is something that the Via Lactea has recently measured. So it goes down to say about, I don't know, so their host halo mass is about 10 to the 12 solar masses. They can measure substructure with mass scales about 10 to the 6. Okay, and it seems to rise, like, say, m to the minus 2 towards lower masses. Okay, so you'd expect maybe that this would continue down all the way. At some point, there's some cutoff scale that gets introduced based upon what the physical nature of dark matter is. You know, what's the free streaming like the CDM? Maybe there's an imprint from acoustic oscillations when the CDM was coupled to the rest of the fluid. I'm not going to talk in too much detail about these this kind of stuff. I think we might have talked about this later on. But the question is, there's going to be a difference between what the minimum mass galaxy exists, what's the minimum mass object that hosts luminous stars, and what's the minimum mass object that exists, period, in the universe. Okay, so these are going to have, so the minimum mass galaxy might be set, you know, by some sort of astrophysical process. Okay. Well, we know the minimum mass halo is set by dark matter properties, but the minimum mass halo might be observable in something like gamma ray signals when you boost indirect detection signals. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a slide later on here. This has been done by several people in this room, and it's sort of a hot topic of recent discussions in the literature. And it also might have implications for direct detection, which I actually won't talk about, sort of what this minimum mass halo is. So this is kind of the motivations, basically. We want to know if we can map this thing onto this thing, okay, basically, is theory roughly consistent with what we observe. Okay, so we're going to learn about that through the kinematics of, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Okay. So I'm actually not used to using PDF. Let me, so what do I do? View. Did I click on one? Oh, good job. Okay. Okay, that's actually good. So so I should mention I've got probably a lot fewer slides than minutes on the clock, so if anybody has any questions, you should feel free to interrupt me. not that that would be a problem. This is Coppasoff 1 and Coppasoff 2. These are two very new globular clusters that were recently detected. So so basically, if you've ever been to sort of a conference or workshop where these issues get discussed, this is a figure that you just cannot get away from, no matter how hard you try. And it's actually quite informative. So Beth actually showed this and discussed it. So here's a newer version of the figure made by Shane Walsh, who's a student working with Beth. And you know, here once again are the globular clusters. Okay, span sort of a wide range here. Here are the dwarf galaxies, both M31 and Milky Way dwarf galaxies. And here are these new guys that we don't really exactly know what to do with yet. So basically, from a kinematical perspective, and basically from a classification perspective, it was always believed that these, you know, galaxies here, no galaxies here, dark matter here, no dark matter here. Okay, and the reason for that was basically, these globular clusters, say, have velocity dispersions of order maybe 5-10 kilometers per second or so. Okay. Because because the radii of these systems are small, okay, all of the dynamical mass can be accounted for by the stars themselves in these globular clusters. You know, that's pretty much a true statement, depending a little bit on the mass to light ratio of the stars. Okay, you kind of go over here. The systems are more extended, but the velocity dispersions are the same. Okay, what that turns out to mean in the context of the kinematic models is that you no longer can account for all the mass that you deduce from the luminous matter alone. Okay. So therefore, there was sort of this classic sort of dynamical separation line between a dwarf galaxy and a globular cluster. And as Beth was saying, we don't know why this gap actually exists. Okay, you might be able to wave your hands for some theoretical reasons, which I'll maybe explain later, why this should exist. But the interesting thing to note here is that there's a set of new objects here that are all within about 50 kiloparsecs of the Milky Way. So these are the nearest satellites that we know of, maybe outside of Sagittarius. Okay, and these things are sort of filling in this gap right here. The question is, why is that true? Okay, I mean, maybe it might be a selection effect at some level, because these are also the least luminous things that we know. Okay. Non-kinematical? I've modeled a few globular clusters, and I've found that, you know, to first order, they're consistent with having mass to light ratios of order 1. So not like, you know, enormous mass to light ratios. That might not be true for every single one. So for example, one question I'm sort of really, really interested in, and I'll actually just talk about this more later, is like, what's the deal with these sort of low luminosity globular clusters? You know, as far as I know, we don't have any kinematic data on these really low luminous systems. So we don't. Right. I mean, there could be, yeah, at some level, maybe unless you have the detailed model, say, of the orbits of these globular clusters, there's nothing that, say, precludes the fact that they might be embedded in larger halos, as far as I know. Yeah, that's once again why it depends upon the properties of the cluster and its orbit and stuff like this, so. That could be true, but once again, you need to know those properties. Yeah. 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 The light, the edge of the light.
flops up tidal tails.
Well, many are.
Well, maybe like the disky ones nearby. There's evidence for tidal currents.
Yeah.
I would say it's on the order of 10. Yeah. Like,
oh, I see.
I thought so. I could be mistaken.
I don't know. I only know a few beautiful examples.
Yeah, there's one that I know for sure, which is Palomar 5.
It is Palomar 5. So Ed Carl Grohmeyer has published titled, so the stuff that's been done post-SDSS, there's a number of spectacular examples, but stuff that's been done earlier, sort of more, I think, specialized stuff. I forget some of the authors, maybe Capuzzo Dolcetta et al., where they had smaller samples of not these huge streams, right, but sort of local disturbance around some nearby globular. So I think it argues against dark matter halos to explain globs as a population, but yeah, I don't think you can rule out.
I mean, some four satellites, I think, have disrupted natural kind of features, and you still think they have dark matter.
Yeah, I mean, it's not clear, but that's an unclear question as far as dwarfs. There's only, I mean, I think generally, conclusively, there's only Sagittarius, which is observed.
I think the point is that if there are stars that are at the center are being tidally streamed, if dark matter is supposed to be out there, much looser, must have been tidally streamed.
Right, yeah. It was already gone.
Yeah.
I can actually jump into this next slide here. So there's always this question of, like, if you look at the velocity dispersion profile of globular clusters, like, are they flat? Do they fall at the end? And that was also sort of the classical way to, deduce if they were being tidally stripped or not. I don't know if that's actually the best probe or not. But basically, what I'm going to focus on here are now the classical dwarf satellites. Okay. So thanks to, in large part, to Matt Walker and a lot of his collaborators at Michigan, this field has actually undergone, in the past couple of years, sort of an enormous amount of influx in data, as you can see here from his FJ letter last year. So these are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of the older dwarf satellites, and in many of these cases here, you see, there's anywhere from say hundreds to several thousand minus light velocities that are now known in each of these satellites. And so you compare this to maybe like 3 or 4 years ago, where at the most maybe like 50 to 100 in these guys. So basically, the question is, Does this now say to sort of conclusively say that these things are embedded in dark matter halos? So what Walker et al. Did here is they said, okay, let me just assume all these dotted lines here sort of mask followed light models. Okay. And so you can see that these might actually fit the profiles in the center for some of the cases, maybe not in others. But you can see these mask followed light models sort of miserably fail out in the outer regions. And all these lines here assume that dark matter. So it assumes a two-component dark matter model. So these guys assume a two-component dark matter model. Two-component dark matter plus stars. Okay, so basically, this is essentially, you could interpret the evidence that these things are extremely dark matter dominated. Okay.
Is the stellar mass light ratio constrained all the
systems? Yes, the stellar mass light ratios. I mean, not from the dynamics.
Right. Oh,
not from the dynamics, no. But just from, I guess you can say with just by looking at the populations, right?
From colors,
yeah. Yeah.
And they're typically like.
They're typically of order 3-ish. Is that right?
I'm sorry, I missed the beginning of.
What's the typical mass to light ratio for these stars and these galaxies?
Oh sure, yeah. Just
okay.
So are these NFW fits?
Yeah. So what he presented here are actually NFW fits. But
working upon, except for the top one, I guess.
So these are like these are basically mass followed light, essentially king profiles.
And I mean, the NFW doesn't seem to fit up there for some
reason. Oh, out here, yeah, it's actually true that there's in some cases these dispersion profiles actually rise, and that's actually been a cause of sort of great amount of literature and hand wringing about whether maybe tidal disruption is actually happening in these satellites. There's actually other reasons.
Isn't it just flat rotation curves?
Oh, these things actually don't rotate.
No, I don't care. If they did, they would be flat.
But the thing is, like, the light distributions actually end at about, say,
I could draw a horizontal line through all of those, couldn't I? With light from chi-squared.
Yeah.
Which I would for many large spirals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. They're not
baryon dominated everywhere.
They're not baryon dominated, and you see the difference at the Magellanic Cloud scale. If you look at peak velocity versus luminosity or something, you can see where baryon domination kicks in. So that is true, but with a different scale.
So we talk about the conspiracy. But here, there's no conspiracy needed, but you have flat rotation curves still.
Yeah.
Flat sigma still seems to obtain.
Yeah.
So Louis, what's the latest on like the effects of like binary stars?
Actually, we're kind of working on that model right now. But I was going to keep working on that. But the effects we believe are actually from binary type stuff in sort of these jitters, atmospheric jitters. That's actually really big small. Okay.
Well, Louis, the other point is about the question about dark matter globules. Look at least some globules. You definitely see a fall in the velocities.
That's actually true. You could interpret that as evidence that there is no dark matter actually in those systems, right? Because these velocity dispersions should go exactly at zero, right, at the tidal radius of the stars, the tidal radius of the stars.
But is that, and so I know I've seen some papers recently that have claimed there are globular clusters that do not have falling velocity dispersion profiles, and I don't know what the status is of interpreting or testing those.
There are some cases where you clearly see a drop in other cases.
Right. Do you have any idea what the frequency?
No. So there's not too many cases where this has been done very well.
I should also mention too that you should sort of take these points for what they're worth here, because these are velocity dispersions that are averaged over really small bins in the center here, whereas this is just the average over one very very large bin here. So that actually might introduce sort of some error in how they're plotting this. So actually, what I'll argue in the slide here is this actually might not be the best way to look at this this whole thing. So at the end of the day, what I want to kind of get across here is that. When you do the mass modeling here, you do the two-component mass modeling, you assume that the dark matter halo follows something, some sort of general density profile, and you assume that the stars follow something that looks like a King profile. Okay. Basically, there's some quantity out of this modeling, out of this great data that comes about, that is actually very, very strongly constrained. And that quantity actually does not happen to be the maximum circular velocity, and the obvious reason is because the maximum circular velocity for these halos is typically attained somewhere out here. Okay. So the question is, like, what is this data probing? What is the data measuring? And it turns out that it's sort of the integrated mass within some fixed physical radius, say right around King 4 radii R. That's actually the quantity that actually this data probes. And then I guess, as you'll see in the next slide, like these, with this data, we have sort of 10-ish% measurements on what the mass of these halos are.
Well, is there anyone else amazed with me at the small difference among sigmas?
Yeah, actually, that's the point I'll get to in the next couple slides here, like what the implications of that are. Yeah.
You're now very sensitive to the way you pick your radius, because you have a flat curve here, then the mass of the increase radius will increase linearly with the radius. So
yeah, that's actually true, yeah. Yeah, exactly right. So, right, that's a good point. So, like, the mass out here is not as well constrained, say, like the mass in here. Yeah, it's basically, yeah. I mean, it's a little better than the maximum circular velocity because, the maximum circular velocity is an integral over the mass and sort of the dynamics probes with the total.
Ideally, I think you one would like to fix a radius that is different for each system, that is.
Yeah, ideally, for each system, there's an optimal radius, right? Okay, but as I'll show in this slide, you're sort of, the next slide. So for comparison purposes, you want to pick a sort of fixed physical radius if you're comparing to theory. Okay, I'll show that slide in a second. So these are the only equations I'll show. I don't usually show these in talks, but people usually want to know how we do this. So this is what I'll say. It's actually not sort of anything typically too unstandard. So basically, to model a dark matter halo, we just simply start with a standard James equation. You integrate along the line of sight here at some projected radius. Okay, so this actually doesn't account for sort of the variation of the line of sight velocity across the face of the dwarf. That actually has some interesting effects, which I'll talk about later. So the real thing you have to worry about here is, like, what's the velocity anisotropy of the stars in these systems, which is just simply defined as 1 minus the tangential divided by the radial velocity dispersion in 3 dimensions. So basically what we want to do is we sort of picked some functional form that made this as flexible as possible, just so we weren't introducing any, we accounted for all the degeneracies in the system. Okay. So we maximize a likelihood function then, which looks like this, which gives you the probability of obtaining a set of line of sight velocities. So now we're dealing at the velocity level here. Given some theory, okay, which predicts the velocity dispersion, and this theory is some function of all the parameters, okay, through this guy right here. So here's you input actually the velocities of stars, and there's some dispersion in these guys. One which comes just from the measurement uncertainty right here, of the measuring, the uncertainty of measurement of the velocity of a star, and here's the intrinsic dispersion, which actually probes the dynamical mass, which is what we're after. Now, this equation doesn't assume any rotation, which I'll show in a couple slides. It's a pretty good approximation of what's going on here. So basically, it's just a maximum likelihood analysis using the James equations, okay, and a variable velocity anisotropy. Okay, so what are the implications of this now? So we apply these to each of these systems, and we determine what the masses are of these dwarf satellites. And this is a paper we wrote last year with the Galactia people, and said, okay, we know the masses. I've actually suppressed the error bars on these masses, but they're actually quite small, so like 10%-ish. So what we want to do is now make a quantitative comparison to CDN. We want to get rid of that, say, you know, cumulative N versus V max plot, okay, where you can do a bunch of shifting on every axis and make anything consistent with itself. What do you find here? Well, here, once again, you find here's the entire mass function of the Galactia subhalos over this mass range of about 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 8 or so. Here's what we found for the mass function of the observed satellites, these black squares. Okay. So as you can see, the black and the red basically aren't consistent with each other. Okay. If you compare it to the whole distribution, but once again, kind of like Beth was saying, that Eric was doing is if you subselect on the samples in the simulation, you say what are the earliest formers, what are the largest before accretion, then you get basically a flat mass function for those guys over the appropriate mass range. Okay, so you're basically left to conclude, and this conclusion was drawn also by Simon and Jihan when they did announce the new satellites, that in the context of CDM, probably what we're seeing is some combination of these two objects, or of these two populations, which overlap quite a bit in Galactia. But but more importantly, there's no error, but once again, I suppress the error bars, but it's, you can't shift these black points over to lie on top of the red points, okay? Okay, which sort of rules out the idea that these are sitting in the most massive subhalos at z equals zero.
Did you have a freedom of adjusting the vertical normalization?
No, this is actually fixed by the number of satellites.
The actual number.
Yeah. Yeah.
So also how sensitive is the curve to the resolution? If you have a higher resolution.
Oh, these are all very, very massive.
I know. I mean, for some small subhalos. For some small subhalos, they suffer from very heavy cadence disruption.
I'm sorry, I can't hear that. Okay, sorry. Yeah, I missed an important point here. This is the math, the integrated mass within about 600 parsecs. Okay, that's sort of the fixed radius that we chose to compare to the theory.
Of what? Of us?
Of the center of the galaxy. So you take these dwarf satellites, it's the mass within 600 of all those dwarfs.
Mass that you report,
yeah.
600. No, we can report a total mass, but we can also go on.
I'm sorry, the mass. So yeah, so the black curve is the mass of the dwarfs within 600. Okay. This is the mass of all the subhalos within 600. So that's the comparison. Yeah.
Why is there no error bar?
There is actually an error, but I suppress them because they're not important. So there's a big scatter between these. So these populations would overlap, the green and the green and the blue.
But the data,
there's no error bar because the mass is, like I said, constrained about 10% in all these cases.
But there is Poisson error. I mean, this is
yeah.
So I mean, how many? You have you. This is for like 20.
This is for like this is for about yeah. So 11 satellites approximately.
But there's a large Poisson error here, which you're not talking about.
Yeah, I actually suppressed that too, right? But the point is like the point I wanted to make here is like these things actually they don't shift, yeah. To the left or right.
But if you plotted the errors, then they might not. I mean, that conclusion may not be.
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have the plot where I did plot the errors actually, but. Yeah, I mean it doesn't sort of ruin to make conclusion about shifting over. Yeah. Yeah, because the point is like these masses are like really constrained.
Yeah, the mass is constrained, but the number if you have two objects, then how much can you constrain the mass function?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But it's not just Poisson errors, right? As Beth was showing, you're missing a large fraction of the satellite.
Yeah, exactly. So,
but do you account for that in these?
Do you mean just not including the new ones, or?
We haven't actually
included any. So this was done basically before sort of all the new stuff came out. Okay, so basically the point I want to make when we did the old ones, actually it's really the larger point I want to make in this figure is like now the proper comparison when you analyze the data is in terms of some integrated mass within some radius around the satellite. Okay, and to not use maximum circular velocity.
That 600 parsecs is roughly the half-life radius.
It's roughly the half-life radius.
So there's two things, observational things. Half-life radius, you can actually measure
Yeah.
That's inside of that because you've got stars tracing it.
Exactly, yeah. So that's
just that all of the galaxies happen to be about 600.
That's approximately about the king radius for many galaxies. And it's also motivated by the fact that they could resolve this. Vialecki could resolve 600 parsecs in their simulation, which is pretty close to the limit of what they believe. Yeah. Yep.
This may be a stupid question, but the high number at high mass is...
This is the large and small Magellanic cloud, actually.
Oh,
that's it.
Okay.
That's the only one. Yeah. So we actually didn't model these. We just said that they were.
So that's it. Sorry, that's what I was talking about earlier. Yeah. That's the variance.
Yeah, exactly. So right, these are in the context of dark matter, right? There's some contribution. There's some non-significant contributions from variance.
You've got more mass within the energy.
Exactly. So yeah, you have to kind of take this point out here with appropriate caution.
Can I check again? The lower right square says that at 10 to the 8th solar masses, you have about 2.
Yeah, that's about right. Yeah.
In the simulation.
Yeah, yeah. So there's actually, yeah, there's large source.
Can't be right. Surely at 10 to the 8th, there are more than 2 dwarf halos.
Oh, so that's the virial mass you're talking about.
Yeah, the virial mass. This is the mass within 600 parsecs.
That's the mass of the satellite.
The mass of the satellite, yeah.
But the number of satellites in the Milky Way.
Right.
In the simulation.
Right.
At 10 to the 8th solar masses is 2.
10 to the 8th solar masses is
600 parsecs. It's not the mass of the satellite. Yeah. Or it's not the total mass of the satellite. It's only the mass within the very satellite.
I see. And there are just 2
simulation. This actually depends on lots of.
But their total
mass. But why doesn't the Magellanic Cloud fit in there?
No, their total mass is 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10 solar masses.
Okay.
The mass on the bottom axis is just the mass.
Okay.
So there's a factor of 100 or something.
Okay. So now, basically, what this did was introduce a technique. The next thing we want to do is, okay, let's actually just do this for the newly discovered dwarf satellites. Okay. We're like, okay, you know, it's an easy paper. Let's follow this up. But the question is, it actually became a lot more interesting actually when we looked at the new dwarf satellites, and this is actually why. So this is a paper which has sort of in press right now. It'll probably get after piece pretty soon. What we found is that the new dwarf satellites tend to be less extended than the older ones. Okay, so instead of using 600 parsecs that characteristic radius, we use about 300 parsecs or so. Okay, it's approximate once again about the core radius for each of these guys. But what we find here is when we measure that particular mass. Okay, and if you plot that versus the luminosity of the system, what do you find? You find this really interesting fact that all these guys are the older ones that have smaller error bars, and all these guys are the newer ones here. Okay, and basically what the interesting thing you find is this is completely flat over 4 orders of magnitude of luminosity.
That's sigma.
Almost. Okay, so the question is that, okay, so for Wilman 1, say something like this velocity dispersion, maybe like 5 kilometers per second, okay, over the whole galaxy. For these guys, maybe up to 10 kilometers per second, okay. But it's not exactly sigma because if you sort of use like a simple virial theorem estimate, you get sort of the mass proportional of sigma squared times the core radius, which actually doesn't completely produce this correlation. Okay, the real sort of relation, if you do 2 component models, it's approximately inversely. So the mass is about, you know, sigma squared over approximately with the core radius of the system, okay. So at some level, there's a conspiracy going on between the sigma and the core radius that actually makes this continue to be flat.
Do you have an explanation?
I don't have an explanation yet. This is just sort of throwing out an empirical result. One thing you could ask is that, right, are we probing the minimum mass dark matter halo that exists? That's a possibility. Also, you know, when we've sort of done the rough comparisons to the CDM models, we found that just because of how the concentration versus mass relation evolves sort of down the low masses, sort of the mass, there's a smaller scatter in the mass within 300 parsecs than there is the total mass of the whole halo. Okay, so nominally, so the rough comparisons we've done so far says this is not necessarily consistent with sort of the subhalos that would be. We haven't actually done anything really.
But this is saying that basically all the satellites have the same density?
All the satellites have the same density, basically, right, within some radius. Yeah.
Also, I mean, gas clusters have the same central density, so if you plot gas clusters, then it's to the right, you get the same number?
Yes, that's actually a good question. So a point that we've actually been discussing is like, where do you put like the Milky Way on here, right? So it actually, it's not actually too far from about right here. Probably. Okay. Well, actually farther on here, but yeah. So
same mass moving beyond the cluster.
It's probably a little higher. I actually haven't done that dynamical modeling for the Milky Way, and that's actually harder because you got to worry about the stars.
10 to the 7 about 10 parsecs.
Yeah.
Is 10 to the 7 within 10 parsecs?
Okay, so it's
like 10 to the 8.
Yeah.
And it goes roughly linearly, so it's higher.
Yeah.
But these are all, this is dark matter mostly?
So that's a good question, actually. So for these, it's dark matter because these luminosities are so low. For these, within 300 parsecs, for a couple of these, I've Fornax is one of them for sure, Sculptor is one another one. There's pretty significant contribution from the stars, actually, there. And you can see that from that Walker figure, where if you just fix to the central points, the mass was pretty well accounted for by the stars.
You may expect this to rise then beyond that last.
You mean
one.
Rise up here?
Yeah.
Yeah, you definitely would at some level, because then you get to like the Milky Way and stuff like this.
So it's 0.1 solar mass, et cetera.
That's the density, exactly.
So was, I
think
I remember Gilmore, Jerry Gilmore, similar?
So what he was doing was he was saying, so he said that was true for the older satellites, basically, based upon sort of, in one way it's mass follows light models, and they're talking about the mass of the whole halo. Okay, so now we're not claiming that the mass of, say, the entire halo of Fornax is 10 to the 7, something probably much larger. Maybe 10 to the 8, 10 to the 9. But the point is we can't measure that because, you know, we don't know how far the halo extends. So I would say 10 to the 7 is an appropriate mass scale for this radius. It's not the appropriate mass scale for the whole halo. Okay. So, it turned out that number is the same as what he was talking about before. Yeah.
And I think another important improvement to point out, right, is that you've marginalized over anisotropies of orbits and the central density.
Yeah, so right. So that's actually a good point. So the mass within this radius is fixed. Say the anisotropy of the stars is not determined by these measurements. The central density cusp is not, or core, is not actually determined by these measurements. Okay, so I mean, it's a true statement that you know, all these data sets still, you know, cores, central density cores and cusps are still, you know, good fits to these data. Okay, because it's hard to sort of extrapolate these dynamics towards the center regions. Okay, yeah.
So if the formation times for the halos were all the same, would you expect these densities to be sort of comparable to each other?
Approximately, yeah. So I think we, I forgot what the number was. What was the redshift at which, I think we said redshift of 11. We have 10 about, if you trace it back, yeah.
So the masses and densities are very consistent with CBN.
Yeah.
It's just the scatter, I mean, it's the huge scatter and the velocity.
I mean, really, when you sort of boil this down, like, that's the $10 million question, like, why this, you know, why is large span?
Some of these have multiple stellar populations.
That's actually true, but that actually doesn't affect the dynamics.
No, I'm just thinking, I mean, if you were going to invent an end-wave model where you form stars that burst, you know, clouds, fixed mass, or whatever, one obvious problem is that you have to put new stellar populations in. Mm-hmm. At least some of these.
Right.
So, they have to pretend. Okay. Where would Leo T's fitting right there?
Oh, Leo T's, yeah.
Currently forming stars.
Yeah, right, and it's got
gas. Right. Yeah. So how many stars you get?
For these guys, we've got, so for Willen 1, this is based upon about 50 stars. Okay, so this is why it's important to do, not in terms of, say, the average dispersion over the whole galaxy, but, you know, to look at individual stars. So for these, you know, I think for one, there's only like 20 stars. Maybe this one here, Leo 4. Then for these guys, you've got like 4x, kind of like 2,000. Yeah.
So by the same token, can you say something about tidal stripping?
I'm glad you led me to that, because I've got a few minutes left, and I should talk about that. So basically the question is now, you know, we're assuming that these are sort of equilibrium dynamical system that we can model with the Jeans equation. Is that a good way to look at this? Perfect. So we actually did look at this, and one of the tests we did was to say, you know, if there's a, you know, some sort of rotational signal in this galaxy, then that could, you know, that could either one of the galaxies rotating and the following is incorrect, or this might signify some, you know, evidence of tidal stripping. Okay, so basically what we did is we did another maximum likelihood analysis, and essentially what I'm showing here plots our likelihood for essentially what the rotation amplitude is in all these guys. And so once again, these guys have anywhere from, say, you know, 50-ish stars to determine. So basically when this thing peaks here at zero, that means it's consistent with no rotation. Okay, so Willman 1 here is showing a little bit of a peak at about 2-ish kilometers per second, you know, still almost consistent with zero. Okay, we need more data on these stars actually, or on these galaxies to determine if this is true. So what we usually, the way we usually look at it is just some hand-waving arguments of saying what's the ratio of the internal gravitational force in these galaxies to what the external tidal force is, okay, at their current position. Okay, so and if you sort of just roughly do that, okay, 220 kilometers per second is the rotation speed of the Milky Way at sort of the distances where these guys are. R is the radius of these systems. D is, once again, the distance. Sigma is sort of the average velocity dispersion. If you sort of just look at this, you conclude that so the ratio of the internal forces to the external forces are about 100. You know, once again, if sigma is probing the internal dynamics of the system. Okay, so basically, you're left to conclude then that, you know, if these things are being tidally disrupted, something happened in the very recent past, very close to where they currently are now, that's disrupting them. Okay, you know, it's not implausible. But, you know, basically the more likely scenario which we think is happening is that these are just, you know, remnant cores that have survived tidal disruption in the past, and these things are sort of self-bound. Okay, so once again, we need more data to actually conclusively sort of rule these things out here. Because, you know, once again, these are still consistent with rotating at some level. So I've got a few minutes left here. So let me just show one which people often talk about in terms of tidal disruption. So Beth showed this, so I won't go into too much details. So what do you look for? You know, once again, you look for velocity gradients of the line of sight velocities, so which is kind of shown here. So this is a figure from, I think, Fellhauer et al., where they looked at Ursa Major 2, which is a new dwarf satellite, one of these low luminosity ones at about 30 kiloparsecs that appears to be coincidence with this stream that was also discovered by Sloan, the orphan stream. So the question is, you know, is this object the progenitor of the stream here? So it turns out, I'll just sort of quote the results from Fellhauer, the association is not clear, because if these two things were to coincide, the modeling would suggest that the stellar mass of this guy has to be much, much larger than is currently observed. So stellar mass is about 10 to the 3. It should be about 10 to the 6 if you want to explain a stream this luminous.
Is this an H1?
Yeah, this is an H1, yeah. 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 Oh, it's, yeah, so they're roughly, I don't know, Beth, are these spatially coincident, this H1? In Ursa Major? Okay. Yeah. Right. Okay. So.
So, I mean, I just have to tell you, I don't think it's obvious that you need to have the same exact line of sight velocity depending on, you know, how it was stripped, when it was stripped. Is that gas that was just stripped off of Ursa Major, or is it just happened to lie along the great circle that Ursa Major 2 has been orbiting on? I don't really know. I just know that it's not obvious.
What was the velocity difference?
I don't remember what the velocity difference is.
So the velocity, I know. Okay, yeah. The systemic velocity for this is like minus 100. I forgot what the, if you knew what that was. Okay. How much more time do I have, by the way? Okay, so let me, I'll take maybe 3 to 5 minutes. So let me actually go back to this real quick. So here's what we have, you know, galaxies, star clusters. And now basically the question we want to ask is like, are these really dark matter dominated like they appear to be from the dynamics? Okay. So these actually, so that would tell you that the line is actually not here, the line is here. And then there's also this question, more speculative, what to make of these low luminosity globular clusters. Okay, so Palomar 13 was analyzed in Cote et al. And it basically, you know, to my sort of untrained eye, it looks you know, a lot like these objects here. And they discussed potential hypothesis for what the velocity dispersion was, looks like in Tau 13. You know, it could be dark matter dominated. If it is, it's got a mass of light or two, about 100, if you do the dynamical analysis for it. Okay, so this game is...
Do you happen to know where Omega Sen is?
Omega Sen is actually very bright, and it's one of these guys. And that's actually very consistent with just being, you know, completely stellar.
But wasn't there some idea that this was a disrupted dwarf?
There's the idea that it could be like a core of a nucleated dwarf, something like this. I think that's sort of, yeah, it's a model that you can't really determine yet from the kinematic.
Yeah, there's no consensus on it. I recently counted, there are 500 papers with Omega Sen in the title, and it has many stars that are resolved, and no one can agree what it is.
Yeah.
Makes you feel a little bit pessimistic about these new things.
Yeah. So, let me skip over this. We gotta keep talking about this during the gamma ray stuff. So what I really want to talk about for the next 2 or 3 minutes is proper motions, actually, because this is something that's really interesting. So right now I've been talking about just line of sight velocities. Okay, so the questions I'm going to ask is what do we do if we can get internal stellar proper motions of stars and dwarf satellites? And what can we learn if we get sort of systemic proper motion to the galaxies themselves? Okay. So the first question, okay, so we need SIM to do something like that. Sorry, I'm running out of time. But okay, so the one thing you can do now, if you've got proper motions, you can actually break this degeneracy with what the log slope of the density profile is. Okay, so this is some analytic model that we did in 07 with James and Manoj and I, and said, okay, what are the errors you can obtain on the log slope, you know, as a function of what it's mainly degenerate with, which is the velocity anisotropy, just assuming it to be constant. Now, you can see, so these two, in the case where you have like 1,000 line of sight velocities, you know, these two curves are, if you have a fiducial cusp and a fiducial core, you know, with these fiducial points here, these things are hard to distinguish from each other. But, you know, basically based upon the sole reason that the Jeans equation is weighted by a different factor of beta, right, when you look at the tangential motions, you actually cleanly sort of break this degeneracy. So this is really one of the probably only way to sort of, at this stage of the game, to determine what sort of the central density slopes of these galaxies are. And, you know, if you knew this, you can sort of constrain many sort of new interesting dark matter models, which I think we're going to talk about tomorrow. You know, an interesting point is what if you get, you know, thousands and thousands of line of sight velocities? So once again, there's this characteristic radius at which these things are, the log slope is well constrained. If you get, say, like 1,000 line of sight velocities in something like Sculptor, so with a fiducial log slope that has, you know, something like a little over 1 for a cusp model, you get something that's constrained at about twice the King Core radius. But if you have proper motions, you always, say, probe, you know, sort of deeper in the interior with what the log slope is. So this is based upon some analytic modeling that we've done here. So this is really sort of why you need something like SIM to determine the central densities of these guys. And if I have two more minutes, I want to talk about the paper we just had recently, which is on sort of systematic proper motions of dwarf satellites. Okay, so basically, what can you learn if you know the exact orbital distributions of Milky Way satellites? One, you can, you know, maybe use this to determine what the mass of the Milky Way is, the outer halo. Orbital distribution, like I said, tests cold dark matter. Are these satellites bound to the Milky Way? There's recent evidence that LMC and SMC might not be bound. LEO-1 is this interesting object at about 250 kiloparsecs that's storming away with an enormous radial velocity. So we don't know if this is bound yet. Proper motions are poorly constrained with current sort of HST measurements by a bunch of papers by Piatek et al. But the interesting thing that we learned recently is if you have, say, thousands of stars in these dwarf satellites like Draco or Fornax, okay, you can take advantage of the fact that the line of sight velocity is not constant. Okay, throughout the face of the galaxy. Instead, you get some linear dependence upon how far the star is sort of from the center of the galaxy, sort of these x and y coordinates. And at the end of the day, what you can use that to determine what, say, vx and vy, which are essentially the proper motions of these guys are. So once again, we get some analytic modeling. So for something like Draco, this has HST measurement of about 40 microarcseconds, milliarcseconds per century. Okay, so you know, if you only have maybe like 1,000 stars in Draco, this is assuming no rotation. No intrinsic rotation. This is assuming intrinsic rotation. Same thing over here. Fornax. But you know, you can already beat the HST error by say factor 4-ish. You get 1,000-ish stars in Draco, which is definitely possible. You can also do this, I think, for LEO 1. You can determine if it's bound in the Milky Way or not, potentially with the Magellanic clouds too. Same diagram for Fornax. Fornax actually happens to have a better proper motion measurement from HST. But once again, this actually depends strongly upon say the nature and number of background quasars that you see in that field. Okay, so really at some level, you know, HST can only do so well for some of these dwarf satellites. Okay, so what we really think is interesting here is now you can sort of use this to sort of probe what, if you know these proper motions, right, you can determine, say, what the mass of the halo is, orbital distributions, stuff like this. And I think I'm running out of time, and this is more speculative, so I will stop here. So.
I wanted to press in quick questions, but it might be better to keep long, slow, difficult questions for talk.